Welcome to episode 208 of Sports Geek. On this week's episode, I chat with Spork founder Ben Reynolds about changing the sports commentary game.
Welcome to Sports Geek, the podcast built for sports digital and sports business professionals. And now, here's your host, who is struggling to hold his microphone after a brutal gym session, Sean Callinan.
Thanks, DJ Joel. My name is Sean Callinan, and you are listening to Sports Geek. You might be doing so on our website, sportsgeekhq.com, where you can find it, everything that we do outside of podcasting, working with teams and leagues on what they're trying to do from a digital point of view, especially with our digital dollars process, helping teams understand their digital audience and content and distribution and actually drive more revenue from their digital efforts. You also might be listening to it on other platforms such as Google Play, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Himalayas simply been added from Podcast Movement, and also available on Roku. If you are watching on Roku, powered by Dot Studio Pro, please let me know. If you want to talk to me about the experience, please get in touch. You can do so by Sean@sportsgeekhq.com or send me a tweet at Sean Callinan at SportsGeek will also find me. Or you can message me in the Sports Geek Nation Slack. If you haven't joined Sports Geek Nation, please do so. Go to sportsgeeknation.com to do that. I caught up with Ben Reynolds, Ben Reynolds NZ or NZ for my American listeners, on Twitter. He is from Spork, Spork Talk, and helps it is the Twitter handle, helps you understand how to spell Spork. It's not the bird that brings the babies. It's Spork as in talk. We do talk about that on our chat call with Brent, Ben in Dallas. I've known Ben for a long time and caught up in Richmond many years ago. We talked about it in the pod when Spork was just getting started. So we caught him at Seat in Dallas, and then we caught up for this chat in New York. So I hope you really enjoy this chat. Understand, it's part of the Sports Geek Startup Series. So looking at how startups are changing the world of sport, and I'm really pleased with the journey that Ben and the Spork team have made, and the growth that they're having across the board. So here is my chat with Ben Reynolds from Spork. Very happy to be here in the Upper East Side at the headquarters of Spork with the co-founder and CEO of Spork, Ben Reynolds. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me along. It's a very humble office we have here, but, you know, hot and steamy day in New York.
Yep, and it's a base. It's a base, and you've moved here to New York. But first of all, so as I was saying before we got started, I wanted to sort of tackle this in a bit of a startup series sort of mode, and get a bit of your backstory. We met, I think it was a couple of years ago now, when you were just starting out. Do you want to take us back to that time when, like, the genesis of Spork as an idea came about?
Sure. So I think the best way to do this is I'll take you back to day zero of Spork. So obviously you can tell by the accent, I'm a Kiwi, so it's great to see another down under person from down under up here in New York. But so about 2 years ago, me and my business partner decided to start doing our own sports commentary.
Yep.
Both huge sports fans, and it was the classic, we hate Justin Marshall. For any Kiwis out there, you're going to know who Justin Marshall is. We hate Justin Marshall. We hate his commentary. Let's have our own bit of fun calling the game. So it wasn't a business. We were doing it for a bit of fun, and we just sit in our apartment, watch the Sky TV feed, and broadcast our audio online.
Yep. What platforms were you, like YouTube or?
So on a Mixler was a big one that we used, okay, which is just the audio streaming platform, yep, as well as Facebook Live, YouTube. So we'd just sit there, we'd have somebody running the technology in the background. We know quite a few of the players and their families, yep, and so we'd be dialing girlfriends in during the game and, yep, interviewing them about what's happening and how their partner's performing and things like that. So it was a real hack job, yep, to be honest, but we started out with this sort of ambition of, hey, let's just share our passion for rugby, cricket and New Zealand sport.
And so from that, as a hobby, as a passion, as a sports fan, where did the genesis for Spork? So as we're going to do this, we're going to say Spork a lot, and S-P-A-L-K, if you're thinking of trying to, what are they talking about? I mean, I think it's a...
It's short for sports talk. Okay. So the, yep, S-P from sports and, yep, the A-L-K from talk.
So yeah, so if you're going to Google it, you now know how to spell it.
Correct. We're not the spoon fork guys.
Yes, exactly.
We've had that a few times, right? Why are you guys at a sports technology event when you sell spoon forks?
Yeah.
But anyway, so we started getting a lot of complaints from some of our fans that, hey, your audio's out of time with the video, right?
Yep.
So everybody's watching on the Sky Sports app or on their TV or on some other connected device. They've got us playing on a phone or a laptop, but it's the quintessential problem of radio commentary being out of time,
yep,
with the video. So it's an age-old problem.
And it's something that I think a couple of years ago, I think Samsung did a campaign with Roy and HG, who are famous NRL callers, and they called the Origin from the Samsung app. And it was like, yep, that's, you know, I love Roy and HG and the way they call the game, but it was the same problem. It was like, oh, it's a little bit out of sync.
Yep. And so the problem we sort of figured out, right, was unless you're sitting at the stadium or, yep, you're at a broadcaster's studio, there is no way for your commentary to be synchronized up to the live video. And so my co-founder, Michael Prendergast, he's an engineer by training. I can do a little bit of code,
yep,
more of a business guy, but can do a little bit of code. So we said to ourselves, why don't we try and hack something together to solve this synchronization issue? So we built this buggy little version of that only worked on laptop devices. It hung, yep, off the back of YouTube, and it literally synchronized up different audio tracks to a YouTube video.
Okay.
So as you're watching, you could click a little avatar and it would change the audio out. So very hacky, like I say, only worked on laptops.
Yep.
But we said, hey, this is kind of interesting. We've solved an interesting little problem here. Why don't we go to some local sports clubs and ask if they want to use this on their YouTube live streams?
Yep.
So the first event we went and covered was a Plunkett Shield, which is the domestic 4-day competition in New Zealand.
In cricket.
In cricket, where we would go out to the Eden Park Outer Oval. I'd sit there with a camcorder all day,
yep,
and I would film 4 days of cricket. And then Michael would be sitting back in the office sort of making sure everything, all the technology worked. And we started getting some of our friends in London and Sydney and the US,
yep,
to commentate these games. And so we suddenly had this hacky little version of this, embryo of a business,
yep,
that solved a problem of not having to bring commentators to the ground to commentate.
Yep.
So that was really where the idea started out. And then we had a really funny one where the CEO of Sky TV in New Zealand filled out a contact us form,
yep,
on our website. So at this stage, we're both doing sort of 2 or 3 days a week. I'm still working part-time as an associate at a VC fund, and Michael had an engineering computer science job, but we were starting to spend more and more time on it. And the CEO, John Fallett of Sky TV, filled out this contact, yep, us form. And both of us just thought it was a joke. From,
yep,
our friends just sort of being like, oh, you guys, here's John Fallett filling out a contact us form. But turned out it really was him. And he was really keen to get in touch with us, talk to us about our technology and see how it could apply to the Sky TV world. So a few weeks later, I had a sort of friend of my dad's who sort of poked me and said, hey, Ben, you might actually want to get back to John. He's,
yep,
sort of waiting on your call. And so we went out to Sky TV headquarters. They absolutely loved it, started talking to their product teams about us, started getting us in front of all the right people. And then Māori Television, another network in New Zealand, heard about us, got us into their office. And we said to ourselves, hey, we're seeing all these things of sort of early traction, early interest in our product. We need to quit our jobs and do this full time. So I went to
and
my boss.
Very, very much a momentum play, like, you know, the manifestation of talking about this thing and then having people find out about it and then they talk to other people and that momentum build just led to you leaving your jobs?
I mean, I've got some funny stories later on about how we've got into some of the bigger sports leagues that we work with now, but all about that serendipity thing. But so we said, look, let's quit our jobs. We hired a friend of ours to come and do some more engineering work with us.
And so at this time it was all bootstrapped, all just, like you said, weekends, late nights.
Correct.
Keeping it up and running, testing it every weekend.
Exactly. And so I spent an enormous amount of time at a lot of very, very small sports events around Auckland. The squash national championships, the under 15 volleyball national tournament, the swimming under 18s, all sorts of random events where we would go out to these leagues and say, hey, we've got this cool platform. It's going to enhance your broadcast. Look, at this stage, we didn't know how we were going to monetize it. So we'll be honest, I was standing there for free. So no one's going to say no to somebody producing a cool broadcast for them for free. And so we really started out in that very, very, very humble beginnings. But when the broadcasters started getting involved, we had Māori television move really, really quickly. In about 3 weeks, they went from saying, this is kind of cool, to actually integrating our technology into their website. And our first major event we did with them was the high school basketball championships in New Zealand. So that was over 150,000 viewers. We had a dozen different commentators in different languages and different styles. And for Māori television, for those of you listening who don't know who they are, they're a bilingual broadcaster in New Zealand. So they're mandated by government. They're a state-funded broadcaster to provide dual language audio. Previously, they were flying two sets of commentators, so up to 8 people a game, because you've got to have a couple of teams, to tournaments all around the country. So they're spending $100,000 on every one of these tournaments just to do the multilingual commentary piece. And so with us, suddenly they could do the multilingual piece at a really cheap cost, and also have Fijian and Samoan and Tongan and other languages that could easily provide.
And was that a little bit of a light bulb moment? Because I think the first time that we met, like in a cafe in Richmond, to sort of talk about what Spork was, it was very much in the, you know, the term fan engagement, and how can we, you know, enhance the broadcast, but how can we bring the fans in and have the fan commentators, that kind of thing. That was initially like the initial pitch or the initial conversation we had of, oh, you can have your broadcast, but then you can have celebrities doing it or some fans doing it to give you that alternate broadcast, because you don't want to listen to the standard dry or the standard commentators because you don't like them. And then I think it was at a startup big pitch night where you came in, and the pitch you did then from the initial conversation we had really shifted to that multilingual media rights owner play to go, oh, we can quickly scale multiple language broadcasts for broadcasters.
It's funny. So you've really seen the full evolution of the business from start to finish, which is quite funny. So we, I guess on day one with that Māori television work in New Zealand, that's really where we've ended up back at now. But after we did that sort of first event with them, we went to the drawing table and said, all right, where's the biggest opportunity for this? Where can we really blow this up? And our first sort of thinking was, well, let's just aggregate niche rights and build a Twitch TV, for those of you who are familiar with
Netflix for sports.
Netflix for sports, right? which is obviously the buzzword of everyone's tried to build a Netflix of sport, right? And so we went out to try and do that. So we were going to local sports clubs across Australia and New Zealand, doing all sorts of random small events, trying to build audiences in the low thousands across these events.
But that's a big long, like you need a lot of rights for it to be.
It's incredibly long tail.
Yeah.
It's incredibly long tail. And so what we pretty quickly realized after doing that for sort of 6 to 9 months was, look, it's going to be hard to really break out in this market. We thought the US college space, maybe we could aggregate some more rights, but again, there's some very big players there who
that's pretty much what rivals and that are doing in the college space and trying to aggregate that space. But then
And so really where the movement's been, this would be about 9 months ago, we said, well, look, let's go back to what we saw originally worked in New Zealand, which was selling technology into a broadcaster or existing rights holder that enables them to enhance their broadcast experience in whatever way, shape or form that may take. So it involved a bit of rework on the products, but really prioritising the work we were doing with major rights holders and broadcasters and saying, look, let's build a virtual commentary studio so that they can, one, save money on, on not flying commentators around, and two, they can enhance their experience because maybe they're a Māori television who wants to do dual language, maybe they're a FIBA who wants to do fan commentary, maybe they're a World Rugby who wants to do another dozen languages to some of their broadcasters around the world. And so really we just said, look, let's sell to enterprise. Let's not try and build this two-sided marketplace of acquiring rights and matching commentators up. Let's do what we do well, which is enhance broadcasts for rights owners.
And so in the what has been one of the things that have helped, I guess, that transition? And because you talked a little bit about the incubator you were part of, how much has that sort of helped you pivot pretty quickly and then come out with a really clear offer on the other side?
So once we sort of made that decision, we looked at the market and said, look, there's about five customers in New Zealand that we can sell this to, right? There's maybe 20 or 30 in Australia, and then there's 500 in the US, in North America. So what we said to ourselves was, look, we've got the relationships with Cricket Australia and AFL and NBL and those guys in Aussie. We think we can sort of over time make those relationships into something. But for now, let's go to the number one market in the world, which is the US. And so when we sort of were lining up our plan, we said, well, we've got to Americanize the business in every way, shape and form we can. So I'm never going to lose the accent, but everything else about the business needs to be Americanized. So it meant we went out and took part in an accelerator program, which started about 6 months ago back in St. Louis. So that's the Stadia Ventures guys who are, they call themselves a global sports venture hub. So they're connecting teams and leagues to startups on the other side, as well as incubating sort of 10 to 12 companies a year. Of which we were one in their spring cohort earlier this year. And so with Stadia, it straight away meant that we could get in front of minor league baseball, a bunch of college conferences, America Arena Football League, the Flag Football League, all these smaller American rights holders who, without a program like that, I would have spent 6 months door knocking to get in front of. And then the other big part, which I know we've talked a little bit about off-air in the past, was going out and saying, well, we need to Americanize our cap table. And so it's a process we're just at the tail end of now, but have gone out and raised a couple of million US to really support the growth of the business up here. So kept the engineering team down in New Zealand. It's a lot cheaper. Have Americanized everything else about the business, particularly from the customer focus, and our team is becoming a lot more Americanized in how we do things.
And so your focus now is, I guess, chasing down, like you said, those 500 opportunities, refining the technology from a broadcast point of view, but then also still having that option for. So explain the product from the rights holder point of view. What kind of things can they do with Spork, I guess, effectively out of the box now?
Sure. So I'll give you, I think the best way to do this is give you an example from one of our biggest partners, who is FIBA. So FIBA are the governing body for basketball. So they produce tens of thousands of basketball broadcasts each year. And we have a huge partnership with them on their youth content side. So every year they've got a little over 200 youth tournaments taking place all around the world. Previously,
so under 17s, under 19s?
Up to under 20s.
Okay.
So boys and girls, every continent. Under 14s, 15s, 16s, 17s, 19s, 20s.
Effectively world champs at that level.
Correct. As well as, I think, so this weekend, I believe it's the under 17 Asia champs, where we'll be covering, I think, so the Aussie, what do you guys call your junior team? The Boomers? I know the Boomers are the men's
Boomers
team.
Boomers the men's team.
Diamonds are the...
you'd be testing me now. They've got multiple names.
Trying to think. I mean, the Kiwis are easy. We just go for the Tall Blacks regardless of...
The Australian national teams all have their own monikers, so... Yeah, you're pushing me to try to get the junior teams in basketball. But yeah, Boomers and Opals are the senior teams.
That's right. So we'll be covering the under 17s this week, for example. So what FIBA, the problem they have is they've got fans all around the world.
Yeah.
So the Asia Championships, there's 20 countries competing. There's about 25 different languages across those countries. They can either go and produce a single English option because that's all their budget affords them to do, or they can not do commentary, save some money and just put a blank broadcast out on Facebook Live, YouTube, all of these social platforms. So that's what they do before we came along.
Yeah.
And then, and this is where we go back to your serendipity point from earlier. We bumped into them at a startup event we were at in the UK about 10 months ago.
Yeah.
And they said, oh yeah, fine. Let's go for the under 20 champs next week.
Yeah.
And so just off bumping into somebody in an event, we managed to land our largest partner to date. But the value they get out of it is they're able to sit in Geneva where their head office is. When a game goes live, they're pre-rostered on anywhere from 2 to 10 commentators to call that event. They'll see all those commentators pop up on a dashboard. They can then say, where do I want to publish each of these commentators to?
Yep.
So, for example, they'll push the English commentator, the professional English commentator, to their core Facebook audience. They'll push the French commentator to the FIBA France page.
Yep.
They'll push the Chinese commentator to QQ Live or one of the streaming platforms in China. And suddenly they've got the same video but with 10 different audio tracks published to dozens of places around the internet.
Yeah.
And so straight away they're seeing audience increases in the millions because in China you've now got a Chinese commentator who's talking about the Chinese players and catering those games on a platform, QQ Live, in China. So our platform is all about connecting and mapping commentators to platforms that you want to watch them on. So there's a little bit of, I guess, legacy stuff on our site today that we're still working to sort of push off into the background, which is still supporting a few of these amateur streams.
Yeah.
But for us, the focus is really on this administration dashboard and giving rights holders the ability to choose where those commentators are published to. And then you've got all the classic things about statistics and data around, hey, what commentator's popular where and who's watching them and how many viewers they're getting and those sorts of things. So aggregating all of those statistics.
And it ends up, I guess, again, sort of like I said, sort of full circle, is it opens up the talent pool of commentators in that it's a terrific training platform that someone can learn the commentating game and not be put straight on to the main broadcast. And then potentially, like we're seeing in Twitch and things like that, commentators might be a driver for why people are tuning in. And so that's what you offer as well, is these, you know, hometown bias type commentary that people might want, or, you know, a more conversational, you know, checking in with other people, doing all that stuff that you were doing in your early days to provide, an alternate view or an alternate listening experience for.
It's fans. Really interesting in the US market. So obviously our pitch overseas is really clear cut around multilingual international markets.
Yep.
I was having a conversation yesterday with NAIA, who alongside the NCAA are one of the premium sort of college groups managing various athletics departments and things up here in the US. And the NAIA, they were saying, look, we produce tens of thousands of broadcasts every year. Our number one problem is one, the video quality. So making sure that like the video is well produced and it's got good graphics and those sorts of things. But number two is the audio piece. So today we have a real mix of some schools who provide really high quality commentators. Maybe they've got a journalism department on campus. And then other schools who they'll have somebody's parent getting behind the microphone and sort of just screaming about little Johnny on the on the field, right? Or they'll be silent. And so over 60% of college streams in the US today are actually broadcast with no commentary.
Yeah.
So literally hundreds of thousands of events each year which are going out silent to air. And so what they're really interested in about a tool like Spork is being able to map the talent they do have to schools that don't have access to that same commentary talent.
Yeah.
So just like you're saying, making a marketplace for, hey, we know we've got Sean who's really good at commentating for this school because he knows the basketball team really well. But whenever they're playing away, the away school has a terrible commentator or doesn't have a commentator.
Or
they don't send somebody for away games. So let's get Sean using Spork's virtual studio. We don't have to change any of our rights agreements because all of the content's still ending up on ESPN Plus or Facebook Live or wherever the our rights deal is with. But we're now saving a ton of cost and getting a better quality experience. So that's really been the thing for us, or the eureka moment for us, is we don't want to play in the rights game. We don't want to touch live sports rights. We want to enhance production quality at a very cost-effective price.
Yeah.
So rather than flying people around or driving people around, park them up behind a laptop and let them commentate.
I mean, and definitely also in this market, you know, you've got the Hispanic market and, you know, so you do have needs for multilingual, and it's just been a cost, or there hasn't been a solution to do that.
Yep.
And there'll be definitely sports that it fits for, you know, a lot of the different markets that have, you know, Hispanic, Spanish, you know, that want to listen in their native tongue. It's, you know, it's a really big option for them.
I think another interesting example is so the USL, which is the soccer league or the football league for the English audience on here. But the USL, they remotely produce all of their commentary already.
Okay.
So they have a studio down in Florida where the USL, the league, provides a bunch of commentators who sit in the studio and call the games. So we were talking with a few teams a couple of weeks ago, and they were saying, yeah, we hate the league's commentators. The league's commentators have no idea who our players are.
There's no hometown bias.
They're not
in touch with the stories. And
very sanitized.
Yeah.
Very, very sanitized. And so what the USL and some of the teams are saying is, hey, we can get the radio call that's already taking place in that hometown market through Spork, virtually produce that and synchronize that to the feed and publish it into our existing rights destinations. So we get a better product without disrupting or annoying our broadcasters, which is our number one focus, right? Is like, we don't want to annoy ESPN or Fox or anything, right? We want to help them get a better quality product that gets more viewers watching. So it's a pretty unique, I think, we're a win-win-win for everyone in the market. No one is really losing by
So who are you pitching to? Like, if you've got you're pretty much pitching to the rights holder and then engaging the teams to say, here's the product available to you, and the broadcaster or the rights holder is effectively picking up the tab, so you're not really going into the team asking for money.
So so we chase whoever looks after the production budget.
Yep.
So this is a subtle difference, particularly in the last 6 months, where we used to go and pitch for marketing budget and say, use this as a fan engagement play to have fans commentating and all that sort of
Which
stuff.
Which is a very cluttered space. There's a lot of people pitching for that money.
Correct. Yep. And so instead we've said, look, and we should be pitching for production budget. Because we are enhancing their production, and we're doing it literally at a tenth of the cost of having studio time available.
Yeah.
And so that's been a much, much easier pitch for us to go after, rather than trying to say, hey, we're competing against all of these other apps and things that are out there chasing this fan engagement budget. So while we have a benefit of driving fan engagement, it's not the budget we're chasing. We're really chasing that production budget because we're lowering their costs and enabling them to produce content at a much greater scale.
So what does you mentioned there you've been raising at the moment. What does the next 12 to 18 months look like? The last 12 to 18 months have seen a lot of change. What do you hope the next 12 to 18 months holds for you guys?
I think the big one for us is we're now set up operating comfortable in the US.
Yep.
I think that's been the priority for these last 6 months, and it's meant that, look, I've spent 4 of those 6 months on a plane.
Yeah.
But what the next 12 months for us is about bringing a bit more consistency to our US operations, right? So we've got a packed pipeline of a ton of the sort of second string sports up here where we're just working through projects at the moment.
Yeah.
We've got a relatively long sales cycle. It's somewhere between 6 to 8 weeks in terms of getting from first meeting through to getting some content live and operating. And so for us, it's really just scaling our sales efforts and commercialization efforts up here in the US. We're pretty excited that as soon as you land a couple, the wheels just start to move. And we've really noticed these last few weeks that we're getting so much more inbound and a lot more just organic interest because we have such a unique offering. So a lot of the leagues now reaching out to us and saying, hey, can you come have a chat to us? We've heard it's really working really well for World Rugby or USL or whoever else.
And that's pretty much how that. Like, if we have listeners that are working for a pro team or at college level or for a sport, they can contact you, and then the conversation is who owns the rights, who's the production partner. They're the people to talk to, and then once that you've done that deal or you've spoken to them, then you can come back and start implementing with the teams, because effectively you're implementing at the team. you know, level.
Correct.
Because they're the ones that want the customization. They want to do their hometown call or have their own broadcasters or replace the league broadcasters, as you were talking about before. But you sort of, yeah, got to tick the box with the providers as such.
Yeah, correct. And so it means that the people who we sell to and the people who actually implement or benefit from some of the stuff is a little different. There's a little bit of a disconnect there. But what we do see is, look, as soon as a league or a team agrees to use Spork, they're bringing in and mobilizing their digital teams and the digital folks to come and actually produce content off the back of, hey, did you know that we've got whoever commentating now, sharing some of their previous portfolio work and getting the fans excited by whether it's a hometown broadcaster or whether it's a different language, and really mobilizing just the content generation and production.
And so it's how has that, because sometimes when you work at, you know, league or broadcast level and then it comes down the pipe to the team, it's a little bit, oh, here's something else that we're doing from a league perspective, or the broadcaster wants you to do this, and it's sort of, you know, there's not necessarily buy-in. It's great when you start from the team and goes back up, but the team just gets it and goes, I don't know what this is. We've got a lot of resources. Oh, I've got to find commentators. How is that onboarding process from a team point of view gone?
Sure. You definitely see it, particularly at the college conferences.
Yeah.
So we're chatting pretty heavily with, example, the America East Conference leading into this next college season.
Yeah.
And the first thing they said was, look, we as the conference love it.
Yeah.
We want you to talk to our member schools first so that they can understand, get buy-in and those sorts of things. So we set up a webinar, ran all of the digital media folks from all of the member schools through how it worked, what it looked like, how they could take advantage of it, shared some collateral with them. And then afterwards, they're all coming back with, oh, I see a huge amount of value I can get out of having Johnny, who just moved down to Alabama, but I want him to commentate a game in Boston. So they were then coming up with ideas themselves about how they could leverage it. So for us, it's all about, once we've sort of got some rough agreement or rough interests that there is buy-in, getting all of the member schools, digital folks, people in a room and having that conversation, right? And then afterwards we share various collateral and how-to guides.
But it is very much, so there's a bit of follow the leader. Like, you can sort of give them all the different sparks, whether it's, you know, your team can be commentating on road games from now. They don't have to travel, or, oh, you can now do multilingual, or you can offer a whole suite of options for your sports journalism, you know, department. They can all be part of this piece and can be part of the curriculum. Like, there's all of those pieces that sometimes you have to lay it all out and figure out. Some schools it's about the you know, students, and some schools it's about making sure that their key broadcaster is getting more coverage. And just finding that piece.
We definitely picked a very hard business to start, right? But I think that's what excites me, is we're building something like brand new from the ground up that is literally redefining how people produce content. Very different from sort of your traditional startup, who's maybe they're doing digital ticketing or whatever it is, but everyone understands normally how those things work and how to implement them. We're coming in from the ground up, having to build and educate a market, which does make it more challenging for us as an early stage business. But what excites us is we make these people's jobs easier, get more fans, all those sorts of things. So we're confident that, hey, if we really invest in our early partners, in the long run, the market's going to really benefit from us being around. So,
and how are your geeks keeping up with the rapid change that's happening in the video space?
Yeah, it's an interesting time at the moment. I think the benefit for us is, while we play in the video space, we're sort of platform agnostic. So all we do is alter the audio track that is available on a video stream.
Yeah.
So the cool piece for us is seeing more and more content being produced by all of these platforms like Keymotion and PlaySight and Pixalot, who are going out and installing cameras, fixed cameras that do automated production. So there's a ton more stuff coming in.
Yeah, there is, yeah.
And then on the other side, you've got a ton more platforms where all of this content is being distributed.
Yeah.
And so for us, we're sitting in the middle going, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Because there's so many more, so much more availability of content, and there's so many more places it's getting published.
Because you're not so in-depth built, you know, you're not building on Facebook and YouTube. You're sitting in that as that intermediary in that API space, that they're not, you know, they're not going, oh, we're changing this because of this, you know, we're turning off this option because all the platforms want more video.
Yep.
So you're lucky in that space that, you know, there's been a lot of businesses built, you know, on the platform and then have, you know, the tap turned off.
Yep.
But yeah, you've just got to stay in front of all of those, I guess, different APIs. And if someone else pops up with a new, oh, this is us. This pops up on this platform. It's you just send your geeks to say, oh, we need to do API relationship to make sure our content can be distributed in those platforms.
Exactly. And so the big ones for us at the moment are ESPN Plus and Fox. So trying to make sure that we can publish content into their broadcast workflows.
Yep.
So once we get those across the line, that opens us up to a plethora of even larger rights partners. The social platforms are all really easy to work with. I mean, Facebook, we haven't even had any interactions with their team, right? You just build the integration and go for it.
Yeah.
In both Twitch's and Twitter's case, there's been a bit more back and forth with their teams because they've seen what we're doing in terms of customizing content and said, how can we get this into some of our other rights partners.
Yeah.
It's a win for them because they're getting different.
They're pushing more and more into the media space and want more video and.
Exactly. Yeah. So you think about a platform like Twitch, and they've been doing a little bit of encouraging re-commentary on the NBA G League.
Yep.
And so the way that they do their re-commentary is they force the user to download it to a local piece of software, which you have to install. You've got to manually sort of do the synchronization, et cetera, et cetera. It's like a 14-step process. And so we went to them and said, hey, why don't we just build an extension, which is a one-click button. You click it, you're live commentating, rebroadcasting that content. It makes it much more accessible. And so that's one of the big pieces of work we've got at the moment is integrating very closely with Twitch's infrastructure so that on things like the G League, it's much easier to go and remotely commentate that content. And Twitch love it, right? Because suddenly they've got 20 pieces of commentary content on one piece of video.
Yeah.
Which you're getting, you're 20xing your viewership, right?
Yeah.
So they're quite excited. We're quite excited by what we can do with that platform.
Terrific. Where can people find you on the internet?
Sure. So we're Spalk with the funny spelling, as you said before, SPALK.co. We got to work on trying to get the .com. .coms are expensive nowadays, particularly for short words like us, right?
But that's okay. So and yourself, Ben Reynolds, where can people connect with you on the internet?
Sure. So I'm pretty big on Twitter. I mean, I say pretty big. It means I tweet a lot. It doesn't mean that I have a big following. Yep. But yep. Ben Reynolds NZ is my handle on there. So yeah, that's do a lot there. LinkedIn, feel free to connect with me there. Share a lot of sort of highlights and partnership wins with Spork on LinkedIn as well.
Terrific. Well, I want to finish with the Sports Geek Closing Five. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Do you remember the first sports event you ever attended?
So the most vivid memory I have is my brother competed in the 2006 Mountain Bike World Championships in Rotorua.
Okay. Yep.
And so I have vivid memories of going up and down the gondola at Rotorua while my brother was racing below on the course. And I think he finished 45th or something. So that was good fun, but that was my first sort of most vivid memory.
And so over the past couple of years, you would have gone to a fair few sports events in your time. Do you have a favorite food memory or a go-to food at a sports event?
Yep. So my favorite is in the new Budweiser standing terrace at Anheuser-Busch Stadium, the Cardinals stadium in St. Louis. So spent a ton of time there with the stadia guys. And they've got this awesome new terrace section where they've pulled out seats and standing room only.
Yeah.
This whole new innovation and subscription ticketing and that sort of stuff. But the food there is incredible, right? I love this gentrification
what's the specific food?
So it's these nachos that have a ton of like pulled pork on top. It's a quintessential nacho dish.
Did you eat it in a helmet?
It wasn't in a helmet, unfortunately. They haven't quite reached that's the Yankees or the Mets.
I think there's a few that do the nachos in the helmet. Yeah. And I can't believe, like, it's just a lot of nachos for me.
And but it's total contrast from the key, like, you go to Eden Park in New Zealand, right? And you get some cold chips and a hot dog, and that's about all you can get. But in the US, they're restaurant-grade food.
Oh, yeah. I think the food game is part of the fan experience, and it is something that is definitely got better over the last 10, 15 years. What's the first app you open in the morning?
It's got to be email, right?
Doesn't have to be email, but if it is email,
it's email.
It is email. It does become email, like especially with, like at the moment, like traveling, and you're in these multiple time zones, and you know you're about to go to you're about to go to bed and everyone's just starting to work back home, and then you wake up and you're like, what did I miss?
Yep. The second one is calendar, right? I live off Google Calendar.
Yep.
And if something's not on there, it doesn't happen.
Yep.
And the worst is when you schedule a call for what is business hours New Zealand, but it's the middle of the night up here, and your alarm wakes you up 5 minutes before, and you go,
that's
right. It's cool to get up on 5:04, but
yeah. But that's why I like Calendly as a booking tool, because it lets people book in their time zone. Sometimes it does freak people out because they think they're booking them, but most of the time it does work.
Yep.
Is there someone that that you think the podcast listeners should follow, that you potentially follow or read, and why?
Yeah, so I think if you're trying to think, so obviously I come from startup land, right? So my Twitter feed is a mix of sports tech stuff like yourself and commentators and things like that, and people in the technology world, people talking about how to grow businesses, how to evaluate startups, those sorts of things. So one tweeter who I've got a ton out of is Leo Polovitz, who's a VC over in the Bay Area.
Okay.
Talks a lot about enterprise startups and media realm and things like that. So I actually caught up with him in San Francisco a few weeks back, but I just really like how is it 240 characters now? I don't even know how many characters.
It is. 240. No, 280, I think.
280?
It's 140 too much, if you ask me. I enjoyed the brevity of 140.
Same. I love when people post just really, really meaningful, really punchy tweets, and you read it and go,
Well, you had to. That's the thing. At 140 characters, you had to edit, and you had to get to the point, not waffle. And 280 just lets people waffle.
And the other more metaphorical account that I follow is the Stoic Emperor.
The Stoic Emperor.
Who is, I don't know, Stoicism, if you're familiar with that as a concept, but he tweets, she, whoever it is behind the account, tweets a ton of just really good mindfulness and mechanisms of processing thought, which I find really, really useful, just in sort of the Stoicism mindset and all that sort of thing.
Terrific. And what social media platform is your MVP? And you can probably answer this as yourself, and then maybe from a sport point of view.
Sure. So LinkedIn has got to be number one. Twitter's useful for reading and learning, but I find LinkedIn an incredibly good lead gen tool.
Yep.
I'm on LinkedIn Premium, that sort of stuff, but I find it one, you can get a lot more reach on there than you would on other platforms, and everyone's there with a buyer mindset on, right?
Yeah, and I've been a long-time fan of LinkedIn. As I've said previously on the podcast, sort of signed up, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago now when I was a geek. But the pivot, I guess the effort that Microsoft's put in to better connect, like the feed is a lot better. They're making a push into more video, and definitely, the reach and that kind of stuff. Which
I don't understand a lot of their product decisions. I got a notification the other day saying pick your face filter for your LinkedIn profile photo, and it was a Instagram style.
They're trying to make it like a little bit more like a social network.
Yeah,
and so they're making faux pas like that, but for the most part, things like the messaging, knowing people, more and more people are online from a LinkedIn point of view, so that sort of helps. And I think they've relaxed there. They were really strict on the Ben, you must know this person. And I think I think I've said it before on the podcast, I think the Australian and New Zealander market sort of took that as, that's okay, I don't know you, sorry, I won't connect. Whereas the US market, and I think overall, people are more willing to connect if you say, hey, I'm in the sports technology space, I do startups, I'd like to connect. I'm not going to pitch you straight away.
No.
Want to get to know you.
It's a relationship game at the end of the day, right? And I think it's something we've seen time and time again is there's been folks I've met in the US who, the first time they meet you, they're scoping you out. Who is this guy? Why does he sound funny? Why does he have this accent?
Yep.
Then they see you at the next event, and they see you on LinkedIn with a post, and then they see you at another event, and then they go, actually, I get it. I get what Spork are trying to do. Now it's time to go in and sell. So we're here playing the long game, right? If a relationship takes 12 months to build and develop and they get multiple touch points, that's fine. It just takes that time to educate people on what we're doing. So LinkedIn for me personally, and I'd probably also save LinkedIn for Spork too, in terms of me with a very sales-focused outlook on things.
Yep.
Being able to have a single platform where our investors, our partners, potential partners and friends of the company,
because a platform like you said before, you're platform agnostic. Like you're not going to go in. And again, it's a bit like saying, no, come on, Ben, pick your favorite video platform. You know, I wouldn't do that to you because you're like, they're all your favorite children, right? You're happy to go because it's all about the rights holder and where they're trying to push their content. So as long as they've opened up the API and let your tech work, then it doesn't, to a certain degree, it doesn't matter. It's whoever the rights holder wants to go through.
And I mean, looking at sort of LinkedIn specifically for the company, I mean, earlier this week I was in Atlanta for the MLS All-Star Game. We were doing a bunch of presentations with Major League Soccer and some of their digital teams. And look, I just throw, they put an article on MLSsoccer.com, threw that on LinkedIn. Suddenly it's getting a bunch of engagement and shares from existing partners who are saying, that's awesome, well done, we love your product. Sharing it with their network, and just investors jumping on and being like, "Oh, we see the guys are doing pretty well. Like that's great." So it's a good sort of intermediary.
It's definitely something from a, you know, in the startup world that it helps build that narrative. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, Ben, saw you at the All-Star game. And how did you enjoy seat? Did you talk to so and so? You connecting? Yep. And then, yeah, it builds that story.
And you get text messages saying, oh, I saw you guys are there. I'm at a bar down the street. Come and catch up afterwards. And, we've bumped into investors that way and customers and partners and everything that way. So, yeah, LinkedIn is a fantastically underrated tool, but they make some bizarre product decisions sometimes.
Yeah. You sort of you turn a blind eye to that, to some of that stuff. So thank you very much, Ben Reynolds. Look him up on LinkedIn and connect with him. And check out Spalk, SPALK.co. And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Sean. Appreciate it.
New workshops on audience, content, distribution, valuation, and pitch following Sports Geek's Digital to Dollars process. Go to digitaltodollars.com.
Thanks again to Ben Reynolds. Please send him a tweet, Ben Reynolds NZ or NZ, for those of you who are in the Asia-Pacific region. Send him a tweet, tell him that you've listened to the podcast, and connect with him on LinkedIn or ask him a question in the Sports Geek Nation Slack. As we sort of discussed, I've really been both interested in the Spork story, but also the pivots and the changes, and like Ben said in the chat, the following the money, which is really absolutely pivotal to startups. And I think the multilingual aspect of the offering is super valuable to be able to offer your content to multiple audiences in their native tongue is super valuable. So look forward to seeing, or I look forward to listening to alternate commentaries on different streams using Spork as the technology platform. But if you get in touch or you want to get in touch, please reach out to Ben. Tell him that you listen to the podcast. I do love hearing from guests that are getting feedback. So your feedback to me is great, but your feedback to the guests is awesome. So as always, you can always go to sportsgeekhq.com/episode number. In this case, it's 208. Or you can go to sportsgeekhq.com and go through the back catalogue. Please reach out to the guests. Tell them that you've listened. I really do appreciate it, and so do the guests. Just before I wrap up, just a bit of an update on Digital to Dollars. Thank you for those of you who have sent in some case studies. If you haven't, if you've got a case study that you'd like me to include, I'm looking to include a few different case studies from around the world that fit into the five pillars of content, audience, distribution, valuation, and pitch. So obviously there'll be some real easy ones in the content piece and the distribution piece. So if you've done something particular on a social platform that's worked quite well, that you've integrated with your sponsors and your fans like, there's some options there to put in some really cool case studies. And I really want to profile people that that have supported me and supported the podcast. So please reach out. If you want any more info, you can go to digitaltodollars.com. Currently working on a few different formats of the Digital Dollars workshops. I mean, just to give you a bit of an understanding, the ideal scenario or the key scenarios is with a single rights holder, or you know, being a team or a league and looking at everything from their content and their audience point of view. That normally entails a two-day on-site workshop working through the five pillars and getting as many as many people that are interested but also invested in the process. So rather than just doing the audience, know your audience section and the know audience pillar with just the data geeks and the CRM types and the people looking after your database, it's really important to have the digital folk in there and really important to have the commercial folk in there so they start understanding the different personas that you are talking to via email, that you are talking to via your content, but then also that the different audiences that the sponsors are looking for. We need to sort of have all of those people in the mix, and the more of those people in the mix will help the overall process, which is to improve the process to help you better commercialize what you're doing from a digital point of view. So it's that initial two-day workshop. They're 2 hours in, 2 hours on each pillar, diving in specifically around your team and where it's positioned, its brand, and where the content's positioned. And out of those two-hour workshops on the pillars comes homework, follow-up work for the specific teams that are the owners of those pillars, whether it be data and refining of the audience personas, because you're not going to get that done in a two-hour workshop. We'll get the broad strokes done. So there's a bit of follow-up work and consulting with each pillar team related. And then once that's sort of all bedded down and we know our audiences, we know our content, we know what works from a distribution point of view, we've started to put down the workings of a rate card that everyone feels comfortable with, then the extended work happens with the commercial team, either working on new pitches or reworking current pitches. And the focus is not so much how we're going to go about and secure new sponsorship, which is obviously a big benefit of now you've got this sort of game plan on how to do it, but the initial focus is how can we better serve our current sponsors and how can we increase our revenue and spend with our current sponsors and tackle things like how we're going to get how we're going to sell them activations and show them how it's integrated and justify the increased spend. So that's my goal when I'm working with a single rights holder, whether it be a club or a league, looking at that kind of thing. Then from a conference, then there's the conference scenario, similar to what I did at SEAT and at the Sports Analytics World Series, whether it be a shorter form keynote that sort of runs through the process. And for myself, I enjoy doing that at SAC, the Sports Analytics Conference. Myself, I still think it needs more refinement. I think it actually works best as a 50-minute workshop like we did at SEAT Dallas, which is really high energy, challenging the room, getting really good conversations. I think it works best in a round table type format where we can get the pens and paper out and actually write things down and start having good conversations, whether that's with the people that are in your team or with colleagues that work in different teams. So it sort of works in that scenario. I think it probably, to get full benefit, a half day. I think if we've had more time at SEAT, we would have dove in a little bit deeper, but then we also would have been able to do a few different exercises to start that we would do in the longer form workshop to really start diving deeper and getting people thinking. And then I guess the other scenario from a conference point of view is to do that full day workshop, which allows deeper dive, more activities on each pillar, which sort of fits for sort of league meetings to sort of drive change across multiple teams to, you know, rising tides, lift all boats kind of scenario. So work on a few different, I guess, formats and available. And then the last one is, because all of those scenarios sort of and versions of the workshops are for the execution people. Now, for the people who are at the coalface that are executing the digital, that are crunching the data and the numbers and the people that are out there, you know, doing sales, commercial sales, sponsorship sales, and digital activations and the like. So they're the people who actually will be doing it and need to understand the how, but then also the improving of the process across the departments. One of the things that needs to also happen is to have some understanding of that process at a board level. And so working on a Digital Dollars boardroom presentation and discussion to be able to present why the current process is broken, where the failings are, and the opportunity to increase revenue from your current sponsorship base and to find revenue from new opportunities in these, you know, infinite opportunities that digital offers. You can only sell signage to a stadium once. Once it's all sold out, it's all sold out. Yes, digital signage does allow us to sell more of it, but this, it's still finite, whereas digital and digital campaigns and digital activations is infinite. And so it's a bit of having that conversation with board level and CEOs to help them understand why that process needs to work, and breaking down the silos and getting the communication working between your data teams, digital teams, social teams, and your commercial sales teams, and getting that to work. Because when it doesn't work, and we all know, and there's, you know, be nodding heads of teams where it doesn't work, and you're not alone. It does happen across a bunch of different teams. I see it quite often in different places around the world. Getting that piece to work, we'll see that uplift in revenue. So that's the thing where we can get board level sign in and sign off and buy in. If I put all of those three together, to help you understand, help them understand how digital can be a big revenue driver for sports. Like I've said previously, my goal is that digital be the primary revenue driver for sports by 2030. That means it's got to exceed TV, it's got to exceed sponsorship, it's got to exceed merchandise, all of those things that have primarily been the big drivers. I think digital can eclipse all of those, but I can't do it alone. I need your help, and I need to help you to be able to illustrate that in your teams and organisations. So please let me help you. You can simply send me an email, sean@sportsgeekhq.com, or go to digitaltodollars.com if you want more info. That's it from me. If you have not signed up and checked out Sports Geek Nation, I'd love you to do so. sportsgeeknation.com, check it out. If you've got any questions, please ask them. Really looking forward to some of the initiatives that we're going to roll out in the next couple of weeks. Until next episode, my name is Sean Callanan, and you've been listening to Sports Geek.
Join Sports Geek Nation, access to exclusive Slack and Facebook groups with regular Q&A sessions with Sean Callanan. Go to sportsgeeknation.com to join. Need help with your digital rate card? Not sure how to price your assets? Is there a disconnect between digital and commercial? That is where Sean works best, in digital divorce counselor mode. Book a time for a call with Sean to discuss the Sports Geek process. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/phone call.
Go to sportsgeekhq.com for more sports digital marketing resources.